Microphone is now live.
Just a reminder, this is a live mic, so anything that you say can be picked up in the room. So if we, thank you.
Okay, good morning, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this meeting of the Orange County Housing and Community Development Commission for Thursday, June 26, 2025. I'm going to ask Dr. Mitchell to lead us to the Pledge of Allegiance. Please stand.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you so much. We will now proceed to the agenda for this morning's meeting. The agenda contains a brief and general description of each item to be considered. Except as otherwise, as provided by law, no action shall be taken on any item not appearing on today's agenda. Public comment rights are not unlimited and do not include the right to defame or slander. The use of profanity that causes a disturbance or disruption in the proceeding and is truly objectionable is not allowed, and it may cause us to have to take a recess from this meeting. Public comments must be within the subject matter jurisdiction of this commission. As such, attacks on persons who are not subject to the jurisdiction of the commission will not be heard. Madam Clerk, will you please call the roll?
Yes, good morning. Mr. Boy. Second call for Mr. Boy. Ms. Tracy Law. Second call for Ms. Tracy Law. Mr. Mike Alvarez.
Here.
Ms. Carrie Buck.
Here.
Ms. Stephanie Odo.
Here.
Dr. Tiffany Mitchell.
Here.
Mr. Wayne Carvalho.
Here.
Ms. Carla Wilkerson.
Here.
Ms. Helen Smith Gardner is excused. Mr. Mike Frost.
Present.
And Ms. Cecilia Hupp is also excused. Madam Chair, we have quorum, and I'd like to announce some housekeeping items before we begin. Please note that if a quorum is lost due to members leaving early or other reasons, the chair shall promptly end the meeting. If you wish to comment on a specific agenda item in person, please complete a speaker request form identifying the item number, your name, and deposit the completed form in the box that's located next to the clerk. To speak on a matter not appearing in the agenda, but under the jurisdiction of the HNCD Commission, you may also do so during public comment item. Speaker request forms must be deposited prior to the beginning of the consent calendar, the reading of the individual agenda item, the opening of the public hearing, and or the beginning of public comment item. When your name is called, please come into the podium and begin your comments by stating your name or pseudonym for the record. Members of the public desiring to speak should address all remarks and questions to the commission. Speakers may address the commission on up to three occasions with 3 minutes allotted to the speaker per occasion.
Okay, now we'll move on to the approval of the minutes held on the meeting held on April 24th, 2025. Do we have any public comments for this item, Madam Clerk?
Madam Chair, no requests have been received for approval of minutes.
Okay, I'll entertain a motion to move the item. Okay, I've got a motion from Commissioner Carvalho.
Carla Wilkerson, I second the motion.
Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, motion carries. That moves us on to our presentation for today, What Home Means to Me Poster Contest. We've got some special guests in the audience. We are thrilled to celebrate the winners of What Home Means to Me Poster Contest. Each piece of artwork was a beautiful and creative expression of what home means, and we are so proud of the heart and the imagination that each young artist shared. As part of the 2026 Home America campaign, the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, known as NARO, hosted this contest for children in grades K through 12 who are connected to affordable housing or community development programs managed by NARO member agencies. We received many different entries, and to open up the competition to additional young artists and recognize additional submissions by additional age categories, we reviewed entries for NARO and all entries, another entry area. So congratulations to all of our amazing winners. You can see the hard work display right here, the table to my right, or to your left. So let me tell you a little bit about each of our artists. In the overall NARO entry, the winner that was selected was submitted by Tommy Martinez. Hi, Tommy.
Hi.
Tommy is 8 years old, soon to be 9 in 2 weeks, and she will be starting the second grade at Cambridge Elementary in the fall. She participates in the Campfire After School program every day, and her favorite subject in school is art.
She's almost eight.
How old are you?
Seven.
Oh, sorry, seven.
Should be eight.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. Thanks for that. I apologize. We got to get our facts right here.
Yeah.
Okay, we can't be off. So she's going to be 8 in 2 weeks. Okay, great. So, and I also understand that you love making friends, and that you want to help everybody that you can. So you've got a giving heart, and you love playing and having fun. So congratulations to Tommy. Do you want me to?
Yeah, the certificates.
Now? Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want me to go over here?
Yeah.
Okay. So Tommy, do you want to come forward and get your certificate with your family? You can come up.
You can come up.
Show everybody your art. Okay. And then this is your certificate. Do you want to take a picture?
Yeah, certainly. Do you need us to take a picture too, Dad?
Yeah.
Over there?
I want
to go in. Okay.
Here, Dad.
Or we're staying here.
Here, Dad.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll take your arm.
There you go.
Cool.
Thank you.
One, two, three.
And Stephanie, we have a little something for them.
Thank you.
And you can take this one home with you. I'll give it to Dad. He'll carry it. Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Congratulations again, Tom.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. And then we had three other winners. We had three different age categories. Okay. So for the kindergarten to second grade category, we have Jonathan Salas. Is Jonathan here? Jonathan, as you can tell by his sweatshirt, is a Lakers fan.
Woo!
He's a Lakers fan. And he's 9 and in going into fourth grade? Going into fourth grade, and you have four brothers and sisters, or there's three? Four brothers. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Well, great. Well, congratulations. Can you show me which one is yours? This one? Good job.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful. You want to show everybody? Show
yes.
Everybody. You did a great job.
Please.
Great
yeah.
job.
You.
My shaking hand is not working today. Not ideal, so I apologize.
It's not your stabbing hand.
Not my best.
Yeah.
Okay, in our third to fifth grade category, we have Nathan Robles.
Yeah.
Hi, Nathan.
Hi.
So this is Nathan's art, everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Old, right? Going into grade six?
Yeah.
Going into sixth grade, you've got two brothers or sisters, or two brothers, and you love baseball. Who's your team?
Dodgers.
The Dodgers.
Oh,
okay.
All right. All right.
One, two, three.
Good job. And
here's
a
more important.
You this?
Yeah. Perfect.
Okay, good job. Okay, and in our final category for 6th through 12th grade, we have Caden Ware.
Woo!
Come this way. You did a great job.
Yay.
Yeah, Aiden. Okay. Aiden is 12 and going into 7th grade. She also has two brothers. And she loves to cook. She does her own laundry, which I'm super impressed with.
Very nice.
Loves her family and strives for world peace. Good job. Can we get a photo? You want to hold this or do you want to hold that? Whatever you want to do.
One, two, three.
There you go. Are we taking these with them or are they keeping them? Are we keeping them?
We're keeping them.
We're keeping them. Oh. I might have given a couple of those out. We need to get those back. We're going to save your artwork. Right?
Yes, we're posting it in this. This would be an art gallery. It's our first year.
I took it.
So,
that's okay. I think I gave it to you. So, thank you. Thank you to everybody. There were a lot of different pieces of art that were received, and these were the best, and you guys did a great job. And so, congratulations to all of you and your families. Keep making art, okay?
Yes. So, I know. Jeffy, that's all on that item, right?
Okay, that's all on that item, yeah, go ahead.
We do have a super exciting Brown Act presentation, if you would like to stay for that, but you're welcome to leave, and please take any and all of the food out there. We have to-go containers, we have enough food at this place, so please take the food when you go, and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like to add for the record, we do have for attendance purposes, Ms. Tracy Law. After I call your name, please say present. Ms. Tracy Law?
Present.
Thank you. And then Mr. Fat Boy?
Present.
Thank you.
Happy, thank you. Okay, we now move to public comments. At this time, members of the public may address the HCD Commission regarding any items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the Commission, provided that no action shall be taken on off-agenda items unless authorized by law. Speakers will have 3 minutes to address the Commission, and the clerk will run the timer and announce when your time has expired. Madam Clerk, have you received any public comments?
Madam Chair, we have not received any request for public comments.
Okay, thank you so much. We do not have any consent items, so that will move us to our discussion calendar item. And John Cleveland, our senior deputy county counsel, will be doing a presentation for our Brown Act training. Thank you, Mr. Cleveland.
I feel like a round of applause needed for Mr. Cleveland.
Thank you very much. Good morning. This is going to be a little bit more dry than the amazing artwork we just saw. My name is John Cleveland. I'm a county council deputy here to talk about the Brown Act. This is going to be a review for many of you. Hopefully you'll learn a few new things. We're going to talk about the Brown Act's key definitions and basic rules, ad hoc and standing committees, basic rules regarding agendas, public meetings, public notice, violations and enforcement, how to involve the public in meetings, and potentially curing violations or alleged violations of the Brown Act. So as you know, the Brown Act is designed to ensure open and public meetings that are open and allow the public to participate. The purpose of the Brown Act is to avoid secret meetings and to involve the public in governmental decision-making process. The core concepts involve public notice on agendas that include brief descriptions of the items to be considered and posting requirements that require agendas and packets to be publicly available 72 hours prior to regular meetings. Basic rule is that the defined term meetings of legislative bodies must be open and public, and the actions of legislative bodies must be taken openly in deliberations, including just discussion of items within the subject matter or jurisdiction of your body, be taken publicly. Again, the purpose is to facilitate open government and curb the misuse, or potential misuse, of the democratic process. So the Brown Act turns on a couple key definitions. The first one is legislative body. Legislative body includes the governing body of a local agency or board created by statute, and that includes a commission or committee like yours. Standing committees of a legislative body are themselves subject to the Brown Act when they have continuing subject matter jurisdiction or a meeting schedule fixed by the legislative body. So here's a quick frequently asked question. If the standing committee is comprised of less than a quorum of the legislative body, is it still subject to the Brown Act? The answer is yes, if it has continuing subject matter jurisdiction or has a meeting schedule that's fixed by formal action of that legislative body. There's an exception for what is commonly known as ad hoc committees. This is better described as a temporary advisory committee comprised solely of the members of that legislative body that are less than a quorum of the overall legislative body. And there are certain requirements for using an ad hoc committee or forming one. The ad hoc committee needs to serve a limited single purpose. It cannot be a perpetual ad hoc committee. So you can't have ad hoc committees that go on for years and years. And the ad hoc committee must be dissolved once its specific task is completed. Here's another frequently asked question. If the legislative body creates an ad hoc committee and states that the ad hoc will not have continuing jurisdiction, but the ad hoc actually exercises continuing subject matter jurisdiction and is not limited in time, is the ad hoc committee subject to the Brown Act's requirements? And the answer, of course, is yes. Substance controls over them. So let's look at the defined term meeting. A meeting is any congregation of a majority of members of a legislative body at the same time and location, including teleconference, to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item that is within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. It's important to note that the verbs hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action are involved here. So you don't need to be taking a formal vote to form a meeting. You could be just discussing and inadvertently create a meeting. This defined term meeting includes any type of gathering where members discuss items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the body, including meals or social events. Serial meetings are prohibited, and it's an area where legislative body members can get tripped up inadvertently. Members of the legislative body can't use a series of communications of any kind, directly or indirectly, through intermediaries to discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of business within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. And we'll talk about email and other electronic forms that can form that serial meeting. But real quick, we'll talk about an exception for one-way briefing. So there's obviously an exception for staff to brief members of the legislative body in a one-way capacity where there's separate conversations or communications and to provide information to the legislative body. As long as staff don't inadvertently create that serial set of communications, staff can't go between individual members of the legislative body communicating positions of each member and letting people know how other people feel about a vote or an item within the subject matter jurisdiction. So here's our digital communications frequently asked question. Are committee members limited regarding the items they can or can't discuss over email, text, and social media? Yes, of course. Serial meetings are prohibited even when using electronic communications. The Brown Act prohibits the use of serial communications, including emails, texts, or social media, to discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of business within the body's jurisdiction outside of an authorized meeting. A member cannot respond directly to any communication on a social media platform that is made, posted, or shared by any other member of the legislative body if the post relates to the matter within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. For example, this is provided specifically in the government code. Likes on a social media post of another member of the legislative body can violate the Brown Act depending on the nature of the post. It's fact specific, we need to look at the context, but you need to be aware of this rule so that you're not indicating your agreement regarding subject matter issues that another member has posted about and thereby creating discussion online. Similarly, participation by members of the legislative body in internet chat rooms, blog dialogues, or other online platforms can create a Brown Act violation. So here's a quick pop quiz regarding newer technologies. When could a prohibited serial meeting inadvertently occur? Replying all to an email message, discussing an issue in internet chat room, posting like on social media, discussing an issue on a platform where the messages temporarily appear and then disappear, using an AI robot to communicate the member's position on an issue, or F, all of the above. Of course, the answer is F. All of these things can potentially create a Brown Act violation. There are six exceptions to the definition of meeting. These are narrow exceptions and they are fact specific. This slide is designed to give you a heads up regarding the potential exception. I encourage you to contact staff and county council if you think one of these may apply and to sort out the requirements for each. We'll go through them quickly here just for your awareness. There's an exception for individual contacts or conversations between a member of the legislative body and any other person. For example, the one-way briefings we previously discussed. Attendance at a conference that's open to the public, where the issues are of general interest to the public, provided members don't go to that conference and then discuss subject matter issues. Attendance at a community meeting that is open to the public and publicized. Again, provided members don't discuss issues within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. And attendance at an open notice meeting of another local agency, for example, a city council meeting. There's an exception for purely social or ceremonial occasions. And finally, there's an exception for open and notice standing committee meetings. So let's look at the agenda requirements. Agenda and posting requirements are very important under the Brown Act. Each legislative body must post an agenda with a brief description of the items of business to be conducted at least 72 hours on the agency's website, and also make that agenda available to the public. Otherwise, the agenda must describe each item of business, and except as otherwise provided by law, no action or discussion shall be undertaken on any item of business not appearing on the posted agenda. So sometimes it's tempting to want to try and do as much business as possible during your meeting, but if the item isn't on the agenda, the better course is to direct staff to go ahead and agendize that additional item at a future meeting and take care of it then, rather than trying to add on business that's not on the posted agenda. There are also special meetings, and these are a little bit more truncated. The notice requirements are less than regular meetings. Special meetings can be noticed 24 hours before the meeting. You have to post the notice and deliver the notice to any item of the media who may have made a previous request for such notice. And like regular meetings, the call and notice of that special meeting shall specify the time and place and the items to be transacted or discussed. Yet no business other than that on the agenda can be conducted at special meetings. And this is very rare, but there are emergency meetings. Probably won't come up for your commission here, but emergency meetings are allowed when there's certain emergency circumstances that need to be addressed and the meeting notice requirements are truncated. So let's look at the public's right to documents related to agendas. When do documents related to agendas need to be made available to the public? There's a couple different time frames depending on when the documents are made available. If the members receive the materials more than 72 hours before the scheduled meeting, the materials are public records and they need to be made available to the public upon request. The location where these documents are available needs to be posted on the agenda. On the other hand, if the materials are provided to the members during the meeting, there's kind of two time frames that apply. If they're provided by staff during the meeting, the public must have access to those materials during the actual meeting. If, on the other hand, someone comes in from maybe outside, a member of the public, and they provide a bunch of documents to the members during the meeting, the public must receive access to the materials after the meeting. And finally, if the legislative body receives materials less than 72 hours before the regular meeting, materials must be made available for public inspection at the same time they are distributed to the legislative body. What you want to avoid here is members of the legislative body getting the materials and first, and then making those materials available to the public. This probably won't come up for members as much as it does for staff, but I wanted to make you aware of it. And typically these scenarios play out when there's short notice, just before a weekend. Maybe the website's not updated, maybe the office where the materials are available to the public isn't open, and you just want to avoid inadvertent violation of these public access rules. Okay, so just to sum up, the public participation requirements call for public participation on any specific item appearing on the agenda before, at the time the legislative body considers the item. Obviously, the legislative body wants to consider public comments before it acts. There also needs to be an opportunity for members of the public to address any item within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency, not just specific agenda items, but items of general interest within the subject matter jurisdiction. And the legislative body must take action in public. Secret ballots are not permitted. Here's a quick question that comes up frequently. When can members discuss items on the agenda that are not on the agenda, and are there limitations? Yes, the government code does allow certain narrow exceptions to discuss items not appearing on the agenda. These include when a member of the legislative body asks its staff questions, or allows members of the public to exercise their public testimony rights. A member of the legislative body may provide a reference to staff or other resources for factual information, or request staff to report back to the body at a subsequent meeting, or direct staff to place a matter of business on a future agenda. So who enforces the Brown Act? The Brown Act can be enforced by the district attorney or any interested person. Enforcement of the Brown Act can be carried out through a couple of different means. Lawsuits for involving a writ of mandate, seeking an injunction to prohibit future violations, or declaratory relief, declaring that a past violation has occurred. Lawsuits can seek to stop or prevent these past violations. Before we turn to civil enforcement, we'll talk a little bit about how to cure potential violations. Sometimes members of the public may send demand letters to the legislative body and allege violations of the Brown Act. I recommend that you work with staff and county council to evaluate those fact-specific circumstances and determine whether substantial compliance has occurred. But often, a best practice can involve simply redoing the action, starting over, not necessarily ratifying something that already occurred, but completely redoing it through a proper agenda, a full consideration of the item, and then a vote. And by going back in time and redoing it from the beginning, you can cure and correct a lot of violations. And there are a lot of technical details about when a complaint about an alleged violation needs to occur and how long the legislative body has to cure and correct it. We'll get into those details today, but you can know that a lot of these alleged violations can easily be corrected. So again, civil enforcement can involve injunctions, can include lawsuits that to declare prior actions null and void, and attorney's fees can be awarded to a prevailing plaintiff. This is a significant reason to comply with the Brown Act and a deterrent for violating the Brown Act. Again, to recap, actions typically involve three different things. Actions to invalidate prior actions, actions to determine whether a past action constitutes a violation, and actions to prevent future violations. There are some requirements specific to each that you and staff can work with County Council on. There's also the potential for criminal enforcement when there's intent. If a member of the legislative body intends to deprive the public of information or intends to violate the Brown Act and has reason to know that the public is entitled to receive that type of information, it can be found guilty of a misdemeanor. This is rather rare. So here's a quick frequently asked question. Do the BCC's boards, commissions, committees, bylaws supersede the Brown Act's requirements or vice versa? No. The bylaws do not supersede the Brown Act. The bylaws require following the Brown Act. Your bylaws reference the Brown Act and require compliance with it. They are consistent with the Brown Act's requirements regarding agendas and notices. And the bylaws may describe procedures for operating with the Brown Act, but they do not necessarily supersede them. That's it for my presentation. Are there any questions?
Member of the commission or city council from time to time discuss the item on the agenda before the meeting. From my past training, I understood that that was acceptable as long as they do not involve more than the majority. And also they do not involve me in a chain reaction that you mentioned. Is that correct?
Can you state your name for the recording?
Frank Booth.
Thank you.
Discussions among less than a quorum or majority of the legislative body are permitted.
Are there any other questions? The Brown Act seems straightforward, but it's not. That's my take. Well, thank you, sir. Oh, you do?
Yeah. There are regular meetings, you mentioned special meetings, and emergency meetings. With respect to the special meetings, just wait for a while. Are special meetings, can they be called without a prior meeting? For example, if you're at a regular meeting and you determine, hey, we need to hear this item before the next regularly scheduled meeting, so we want to call a special meeting, or is that something where in between meetings, someone says, hey, we need a, how does that happen where you avoid having a quorum of the body decide to have that special meeting? Does that make sense?
Yes.
You understand the question?
I do believe I understand the question. You do not need to have a regular meeting that sets up the special meeting. A special meeting can be established on its own independently. Typically, the bylaws state the authority to call a special meeting, and that authority is granted to a chair. So the chair will call a special meeting on a specific item of business, maybe even one item, it could be two. That special meeting can take place. We did this a lot during COVID when there were special meeting requirements in order to make findings necessary to have remote meetings and things like that.
So the chair, or the mayor in some cases, they call that special meeting without the rest of the body really knowing that the meeting is actually scheduled, because they would perhaps staff would call on and say, are you available? But the rest of the body doesn't really know there's going to be a scheduled meeting, correct?
The rest of the body would definitely not be setting up that special meeting.
Okay.
But they need notice. They need 24 hours notice even with a special meeting.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you, John.
Appreciate you coming by. And. So this is just a receive and file item. Do we have any public comments for this agenda item, Madam Clerk?
Madam Chair, there has been no request for discussion item on our calendar.
Okay, and I am asking for a motion to receive and file. Anyone want to make the motion?
Motion.
Okay, please state your name.
Matt Boyd.
Okay.
Second. Mike Alvarez, second.
I think Ms. Buck beat you to it. Ms. Buck got the second. And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? See Seeing none, motion carries. Okay, we do not have any public hearing items, so we move on to reports of staff. And we're going to start off with January Johnson, our housing manager for the Orange County Housing Authority.
Good morning, everyone. January Johnson, Orange County Housing Authority. I have a couple of updates for you guys. In the last meeting, we had informed you that we were still waiting on our funding for 2025. But those of you who have been on the commission for a while, you understand that we always receive our funding notice deep into the calendar year that we're being funded for. But for those of you who may be new to the commission, the way it typically works is housing authorities will receive their current year funding in about May of the year that they're funded. So you'll go about 5 months without knowing what your funding is going to be for the year that you are actually operating in. So that is what happened this year as well. So we did receive our funding notice in May. It is typically part of the Budget Appropriations Act. That's how you'll know how much will go to HUD, and then HUD will allocate to each housing authority. Because of the continuing resolution that went into place, HUD received the same funding they had received in the previous year. And so when they allocated the money to the housing authorities, we received the same funding that we received in the previous year. We did receive an inflation rate added to that to account for any sort of inflationary costs between 2024 and 2025. The inflation rate was down from the inflation rate that we received in 2024, so we received an inflation rate of about 3.6% this year, where last year it was 4.6%. And so it is enough to continue to serve all of our current clients, but it is not enough to continue to draw from our waiting list. So we are just in stasis right now. We are not selecting any names from our waiting list, and we have seen our per unit cost to increase. So the way that it works is our portion of rent that we pay, we've seen increase from last year to this year. Last year, the average amount was $1,588. This year, it's estimated to be $1,757 by the end of the year. And so the inflation rate that we received does not cover that increase in our costs. And so we will have to reevaluate as we go throughout the year. And we'll keep you guys posted of where we're at.
So can I ask a question, Stephanie Otto? How can we keep serving our current clients if that doesn't cover it? I don't follow.
Because of attrition. And so we do natural rate of attrition. Yeah, so we wouldn't have to ask any clients to remove from the program because of just our natural rate of attrition. If anything changes, we will be speaking with the commission about that and letting you guys know if something changes.
So yes. The natural rate of attrition is keeping up.
Correct.
Okay, got it.
Yep. In order to support, I think this is information that is always interesting to the public and to any commission members, in order to support all the vouchers that we have been allocated, we would need an additional $23.6 million received annually plus whatever inflationary costs that you would have on each of those annual years. So for now, it's $23.6 million, but next year, depending on inflation, it would be a higher number. And that would be needed in order to serve a gap of about 1,050 vouchers that we have available that we cannot serve at this time. Just as a reminder, funding for our emergency housing voucher program and our mainstream voucher programs are separate from this bucket of funding. However, this bucket of funding does include the family unification program, the foster youth to independence program, and the VASH program. So all of those programs are included in the funding that we received this time. Any questions on funding before I move on to the next?
So yeah, I have a question on clarification. So $23.6 million is needed to serve, is that the waiting list?
No, that's just the number of vouchers that we have allocated from HUD that we cannot touch. And so we have an additional 1,050 vouchers that are available that HUD has awarded us.
So we can't fund the currently awarded vouchers?
Correct.
Got it.
Yeah. HUD requires that you do one of two things. You can either serve the number of vouchers that you've been allocated, or you spend all your money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We spend all our money. So. Any other questions about funding? All right. This is also something that is a repeat for a lot of you that have been on this commission for some time, but for anybody that's new, I'll give a little bit of history. On an annual basis, the Housing Authority does an internal audit that we then have to submit to HUD, it's our own assessment. It's called the Section 8 Management Assessment Program, CMAP for short. Is done every single year. There are 14 indicators plus one bonus indicator. We are currently working on our CMAP assessment right now. When we meet again in August, hopefully I'll be able to give you guys the results of what we have found. We do anticipate that we've been high performers, which means that you have scored between 90% and 100% of the total points. To be a high performer, we've been a high performer for 17 consecutive years. We do anticipate that we will also be a high performer in this period as well. Last year, we received a score of 103% because we received the bonus score as well. I will keep you guys updated on what that looks like in August, but that is the work that we're doing right now, is that self-assessment. Any questions for me? Thank you very much.
Thank you, January. Our next report is from Craig Fee, Community Development Manager.
Okay. Good morning, Julia Bidwell. No report for Craig Fee this morning.
Thank you so much. Then we go on to Michelle Zadiba, Housing Development Manager.
Good morning, Michelle Zadiba, Housing Development Manager. Not sure my report will be exciting as January's, but I'll do my best. I think in the last meeting, we had talked about our progress on our 2025 Notice of Funding Availability that we released in March 2025. Currently, we have 6 pending applications in various stages. Some of them are initial reviews, and so you're not seeing them here in your report. Sometimes when the applications come in, it's still very early, and we include it, then we're removing it. It causes a lot of confusion with the number, so we like to at least get to the point where we feel like we're going to move forward with threshold, at which point we'll take it to the Project Review Advisory Panel for review. So what you'll see in the report for the month of May is 2 applications received, requesting 8 project-based vouchers and $2.3 million. But currently, we do have 6 projects, 6 applications in the queue, requesting $6.2 million. And 69 project-based vouchers. The 2025 NOFA, we did make available $12.05 million. So that's about half of what we have available. And I think in terms of project-based vouchers, the request is about a little bit more than half of what we have available as well, too. Since our last meeting, we did have 2 Project Review Advisory Panel meetings. Where we presented Mark's Way Orange Apartments in the City of Orange, as well as Casa Calibri Apartments in an unincorporated county. Casa Calibri is a project that we brought back for additional funding because they had a gap during construction loan closing. We did recently complete construction loan closing for that project, and so it should be under construction pretty soon. So that's really exciting. And we also took, in our June meeting, took forward Meadow Senior Apartments for Capitalized Operating Subsidy Reserve loan. And that was because the project was not eligible for getting project-based vouchers. And so that request allowed them to be able to use an operating subsidy to offset the operating expenses associated with those 7 units of permanent supportive housing that they were not able to get project-based vouchers on. So a little bit different, where a voucher would subsidize rents for a tenant. This doesn't subsidize the rent for the tenants, it subsidizes the operating expenses associated with operating that unit. So a little bit different, not as desirable, and typically developers aren't able to use it to leverage and get financing. And so I think it's something that we make available to make these projects pencil, but definitely always a project-based voucher is ideal for a developer. And our next board meeting, or our next prep meeting, is July 10th. We do anticipate that we'll bring forward a couple of additional projects that we're currently underwriting that are looking to apply for tax credits this year. And I think that's the end of my report. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Stephanie, I have a question on the Meadows. What made them not eligible for vouchers? Do you remember?
Yes. So the Meadows is part of a master planned community. So typically when you apply for our notice of funding availability, the existing conditions cannot change. between the time that you apply and until you get your environmental clearance. And so what happened during that time was they applied for vouchers, and then the master plan, the master developer graded the site as part of their overall construction. And so once they touched that site, that project became ineligible and can never get project-based vouchers for this project. So right now we're kind of trying to figure out how we work on that with our developers, starting the NEPA process a little bit earlier, perhaps asking for waivers and such. And so we're trying to figure out how we were able to also do project-based and master plan communities where something like that occurs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and finally we have Julia Bidwell, our Executive Director, and Secretary's report.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I'm Julia Bidwell, Director, OC Housing Community Development. Just a few updates this morning. January covered fiscal year 2025, the current year's funding levels. We still don't know for fiscal year 2026. That's part of the federal budget. It's in reconciliation in the Senate. The administration's proposal was a reduction of approximately $27 billion, or a 43% cut for tenant-based rental assistance. It would impact all of OCHA's programs, including all special purpose voucher programs. They also proposed elimination of the Community Development Block Grant Fund program, the CDBG funding program, and elimination of the Home Investment Partnership Act program. So that was the administration's proposal, and we passed the House and now is in reconciliation at the Senate. So we will keep you updated as we get information on that. A little bit happier news. On March 15th, 2023, HUD issued a non-competitive funding opportunity for Foster Youth to Independence vouchers. We spoke about these before. FYI is designed to serve youth 18 to 24 years of age who have left foster care or will leave foster care in 90 days, are homeless, or at risk of homelessness at age 16 or older. HUD established that as long as the funding remained available, housing authorities could apply for FYI vouchers if their combined utilization for their family unification program and FYI program reached 90% utilization. During each federal fiscal year, October 1 through September 30, a PHA could apply for a maximum of 25 vouchers up to two times throughout the year as long as their utilization has reached that 90%. OCHA was awarded 25 vouchers on June 2nd of 2025. We accepted the award this last Tuesday. The Board of Commissioners is the Board of Supervisors, and we go to them for the acceptance of the award. And so as long as funding is available, OCHA will continue to apply for FYI vouchers each time we're at the 90% utilization rate. So we intend to continue to apply for those. So that's an update on the FYI vouchers. That's all that I have for this morning. Just really appreciate this commission and what a wonderful poster contest we had. Thank you to all for voting on those. So, and that's all I have for this morning.
Thanks so much. This is Stephanie Otto. Thank you for bringing that opportunity to us, the poster contest. That was really nice for us to be a part of the community and have them come in. So we really appreciate you bringing that to us. But now it's time for member comments. At this time, members of HCD Commission may comment or on agenda or non-agenda matters and ask questions of or give directions to staff, provided that no action shall be taken on non-agenda items unless authorized by law. Does anybody want to give a report? I have a report. I attended two grand openings since I think May. They were both award-winning projects. One was the Meadows Senior Apartments and the other was Via St. Joseph. Meadows is in Lake Forest, is a 65-unit community developed by CNC Development and provided for affordable and permanent supportive housing for very low to extremely low seniors. The county contributed $1.54 million in capital funding, and it was
the thing that was really cool about it is when they had you tour the facility, we actually toured, someone was living in the unit and they let us into their home. And I just thought that was really, really special that they were so proud and they were so happy to be there and share that with us. So, and the other thing that was really interesting about this is this might be the only project in the county that has pickleball.
Yes.
They have pickleball, okay? And so if you went to that one, you got a free pickleball paddle when you left. So it's really interesting. In Orange, another unique community, I went to celebrated and spoke on behalf as the chair of the commission, to celebrate the dedication of Mercy House Housing's Via St. Joseph, a 50-unit community for very low to extremely low-income seniors that includes permanent supportive housing. That was another award-winning project because it was an adaptable reuse of an existing structure. This was the Sisters of St. Joseph, the City of Orange, and Mercy Housing. The county contributed $6 million in capital funds and 18 project-based vouchers for that development. So it was an honor to be there and represent all of you. Thank you for allowing me to serve as your chair. And if our next scheduled meeting is going... You have a comment?
Yes,
oh, great.
Yes.
Okay, Ms.
Buck. This is Carrie Buck. I attended the White's Place grand opening in Santa Ana, and I don't have all those details, but I did pull them there, so I'll just share. It was actually amazing to see what it was before and what it is now. There are 48 units there for women that are experiencing homelessness or domestic violence. 47, and they have one live-in there, so 47 of them for each of the women. It is absolutely beautiful. There were some people that already moved in that we were able to hear from during that. There was one woman that gave a speech about the impact that this housing unit has had on her and getting her to the next step in life when she thought she had no other option. So it was amazing to see everybody come together from the Board of Supervisors to the city and work together in this project. And then here it says the board approved a $2.6 million Mental Health Services Act fund funding reserve loan for operating that unit. So it was wonderful to be there. So thank you for that invitation.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Buck. Anyone else have any other comments?
I do. Carla Wilkerson. It looks like there's some congratulations in order for your affordable housing awards. Did anybody get an award?
Yes. Are you talking about the Kennedy Commission and
the breakfast?
The clearinghouse? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the breakfast. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think, Michelle, were we, the county was part of four out of five.
Oh.
Yeah, the county had invested either a funding or project-based vouchers. In four out of the five. I think the other one was Anaheim.
That's right.
That mm-hmm. Anaheim has their own housing authority, and so that was the only one we weren't a participant in. So thank you.
Thank you.
This is Carrie Buck. I would love it if you, any awards you all receive, please bring that. I mean, other than just a picture in here, we want to celebrate all the work that you all are doing too. So recognizing that would be great to do on a regular basis.
No problem.
Julie, we can bring the awards along with
the
Snoopies too.
I think art and awards room.
Right? Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Snoopies.
Okay. Anyone want to add anything else? Okay. So as a reminder, our next meeting will be held in person on July 24th, 2025. This meeting is now adjourned.